Discuss, challenge, inform, comment, viewpoint on Talk Radio Europe.
Giles Brown.
Live comment and discussion with studio guests. Viewpoint.
You're listening to Viewpoint Talk Radio Europe's current affairs programme where we discuss the issues of the day with a panel of invited guests joining me in the studio today. Nathan Thomas, Rex Leyland and John Harper are going to be looking at news from across, coming over from the States, as well as the government decision to prosecute hate crimes online, and also Big Ben shutting down, which we'll do the last story of all. We've got a caller on the lines first, so we go straight to the phones. Good morning, caller, you're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Right, Raymond from Mallorca again, Mr. Brown. In reply to Mr. Thomas, what he obviously doesn't know is in Germany and France, they are actually repatriating people back to their own countries. It's already started. In Britain, it wouldn't be difficult. For obviously, you don't repatriate your own nationals. I mean, that was obvious, wasn't it? I mean, come on. So, and what in Britain, I've thought about this a lot for years. What you do in Britain is, if they're Pakistanis, what you do is you talk to this Pakistani government and you say, listen, we give you a lot of foreign aid, right? You want to keep having the money? Well, you accept your citizens, otherwise we turn off the tap. It's quite simple, really. And the lady from Mallorca, what she failed to mention, she probably forgot, less than 2 months ago, the Spanish intelligence services in Mallorca arrested 4 members of ISIS. They were not affiliates. They planned to blow up the town hall of a town called Inca here. There was a cell of 6. The one was an imam in Birmingham. The Spanish police tipped the British police off. The 6 members in Germany. They did a dawn raid, classic police, straight through the door with a battering ram, arrested them, they found the explosives, they found everything. So, you know, we don't know everything, do we? Thank you, bye.
Thank you there, Raymond. 952-78-4000 is the phone number. Studio at talkradioeurope.com is the email, and the Facebook page is Talk Radio Europe Official. We're going to move on from the Barcelona story and go across to the United States, where there have been a variety of news stories happening, all involving President Trump, looking at the situation in North Korea, looking at the still simmering row over the wonderful statue. But we're going to start off with the speech that President Trump gave yesterday in front of his military, announcing plans to deploy more troops to Afghanistan, and Washington apparently putting more pressure on the UK and other NATO members to do the same. Nathan, your thoughts on this America's longest running war, 16 years now in Afghanistan.
Indeed it is. The first thing the president did show us how not to watch an eclipse yesterday also by...
Oh, yes. So
he didn't need no glasses. But anyway, getting back to...
Ordinary mortals, however.
That's right.
Photographs.
Yes, mere mortals.
Rex, sorry, you were going to say
something? No.
You were dazzled by the sun, were you?
Getting back to Afghanistan, I mean, what he did make a major speech yesterday, and it was because he has advocated before, which he said in this speech. He said his gut instinct, and he often listens to his gut, was to get out of Afghanistan and kind of let the chips fall where they may, but he has now changed his mind, or the policy has been changed, and he said we are still committed to Afghanistan, and that means at this point sending in more troops because what is there is not sufficient to do the job. Now, exactly what the job is of course still somewhat vague, and this is the problem. It's not knowing what the mission is, not knowing when you get out and when you have actually, you know, when you declare victory and go home. But he has made the statement, and we don't know the details yet of how many more troops and so on, but Afghanistan looks like it is going to continue rather than turning it into a void, which is pretty much what would happen if he had said, all right, within, you know, as quickly as we can do it, all the troops are going to be pulled out of Afghanistan. Now, he did try to pull in more other NATO countries, to bolster this effort. How well that will work, how much that will happen, remains to be seen.
Rex, your thoughts on the situation?
I would have thought that history is a very good teacher. Sadly, the British experience 100 years ago or more in Afghanistan was not particularly pleasant, with no end result favourable to the British, We then saw the Russians going in, getting their trousers very badly burnt. And now Mr. Trump is saying that he wants to send in more troops into this quagmire of, words fail me. Why are we sending more people in to this country that seems never to get any better? There is no real solution. And he's now just been on the TV saying that he's not going to send any more money to Pakistan because they're harbouring all these terrorists. I think it's madness. I really do. I think we need another strategy, a new, fresh approach. And perhaps we should leave them alone and get on with our lives and let them get on with theirs.
Nathan.
Well, I think part of it, and this is the whole question with it, is Afghanistan, is the U.S. presence in Afghanistan there to fight and rid it of terrorists, or is it there to rebuild the country? And I think this is why it has gone on so long, because people could not figure out or wouldn't make a decision and stick to it as to what the mission was. I mean, you can fight terrorists, and that is one thing. If you are trying to rebuild the country and establish a democratic government that you find acceptable, that is an entirely different prospect, which that is probably, as Rex has said, looking at Afghanistan's history, its tribal warfare, it has been forever, and you're not going to stop that by having an election. You are not going to accomplish that. So, I mean, that is something you can never make happen, I don't believe. As far as fighting terrorists, you can do something. The question is, if you leave, does it stay the same, or does it get worse and get worse for you? And it's the same with Pakistan. I mean, he has said, and it is true, the U.S. has poured billions of dollars into Pakistan, supposedly with the agreement that Pakistan would help in the fight against terrorism. That has not really happens. Pakistan has taken the money, taken the weapons, taken the arms, taken the whatever they were given, and they haven't really fulfilled their side of what really is a contract. And I think in some ways he is correct. I mean, much as the caller was saying, I mean, you talk to whether it's Pakistan or anybody else, if you do this, we will do that. And if you don't do this, we will stop doing this. And I think that is something that may be productive.
Right. The other thing I meant to mention was, of course, the original raison d'etre of, should we say, modern times in Afghanistan with the Americans, Russians and the British, etc., was, of course, heroin. We've forgotten about the heroin. They were talking about, we have to go in and stop the poppies being grown and so on, and flooding the world with wonderful heroin from Afghanistan. Do you remember that was cited years ago, not too long ago? Heroin was the big one.
That was not the reason they went in, though. That was one of those things, oh, well, since we're here, we might as well improve this situation. We went in to punish the Taliban. That's what that was the reason we went in there. And then it was, oh, while we're here, let's do this, let's do that, and then you get into let's turn this into a democracy, let's do this, let's do that, and you can't accomplish all of those things, especially as you said, in a place like Afghanistan, it is not going to happen. But the real reason was to punish the Taliban, go after terrorists. If you limit what you are doing to that, you can have a degree of success. Obviously, I don't think there's any way you're going to wipe out every potential terrorist in Afghanistan. But you have to decide what your real reason is for being there. And I don't know what Trump will say is the reason. That we're waiting to see.
And we go live to the phones. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Yeah, hello. Me?
Yes, sir, it's you.
Hello.
What's
your name? Okay, this is Jim in Holland. I have recently read a book called Three Cups of Tea by a chap called Masterton, who in the 90s or late 80s was separated from climbing K2 and ended up in a Pakistan village. He saw the children sitting in the cold. They had no school. He then spent the rest of his life creating schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And in the book, he was saying that the Saudis had pumped, I think it was $40 million over a period of years into new schools, Islamic schools, and these schools were actually turning the children into minor terrorists. Probably a solution, I don't know how you go about it, and I don't know, it's long term, would be we have to educate children in these countries. Good points are, you know, Islam is a peaceful religion and turn them against terrorism, but they reckon this is where it all stemmed from, going back in the 20 years. I don't know if anyone's read the book or have any thoughts on it.
Thank you for your call in there, John. Thank you. I haven't actually read that book, Three Cups of Tea, but I'm sure we'll have a look at it. Looking at some of the things that I'm looking at, President Trump's very long transcript from yesterday's, yesterday's delivery, where he said that the three main points of his Afghanistan strategy. He said his first instinct was to pull out, and historically, I like following my instincts. This is the Trump transcript. But all my life, I've heard that decisions are much different when you sit behind the desk in the Oval Office. In other words, when you're president of the United States. So I studied Afghanistan in great detail and from every conceivable angle. After many meetings over many months, we had our final meeting last Friday at Camp David with my cabinet and generals to complete our strategy. I arrived at three fundamental conclusions about America's core interest in Afghanistan. First, our nation must seek an honorable and enduring outcome worthy of the tremendous sacrifices. Second, the consequences of a rapid exit are both predictable and unacceptable. 9/11, the worst terrorist attack in history, was planned and directed from Afghanistan because that country was ruled by a government that gave comfort and shelter to terrorists. And third and finally, I concluded that the security threats we face in Afghanistan and the broader region are immense. Today, 20 U.S.-designated foreign terrorist organizations are active in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the highest concentration in any region anywhere in the world. So Trump seems to be focusing on both Afghanistan and Pakistan as well. Nathan?
The one thing interesting about his speech, and what you say is true, but he actually did... and you could tell watching him, he did read this off the teleprompter. He was reading a speech that was written. He didn't for him, and not to say that he didn't have input, but he did follow the script, which with Donald Trump, we know very often he doesn't follow the script and surprises everybody. So I think, you know, it was very interesting to see this time. The things he talked about were obviously not just his idea, but the strategy that he has at least accepted and is, as president, is talking about and telling us. We still don't know what Donald Trump really figures or really feels about it himself, but at least this time he at least stayed on message.
Indeed. One of the other things, John, you want to come back on a point there? Sorry.
Yeah, I can add a couple of things on Afghanistan. First off, there's an oil pipeline going through there. I don't suppose that's got anything to do with America's desire to keep hold of it. Why would it? Secondly, there is an awful lot of CIA-bought heroin that's going into the States from there. Thirdly, they always have a saying in Afghanistan, my grandfather was trying to kill your grandfather. My dad was there. He was up in the Khyber Pass. We've all been through there. The Brits, when they were there, have made the stupid habit of walking around in red coats, which is a pretty dumb thing to do, walking along in a line to a couple group of terrorist guerrillas that have long rifles and shoot you from the hills. The Russians, when they were there, weren't actually fighting the Afghanistans, they were fighting the Americans, because the Americans were supplying the Afghanistanis with all the weaponry and the rocketry to bring the Russian helicopters down.
Yeah, but the Soviets went in first, John.
Soviets went in first, but they actually ended up fighting the Americans. It was a quasi-war. It was a proxy war, precisely.
But they were there for some reason. They wanted to be there for some reason.
Yeah, they wanted to be there because there's an oil pipeline goes through it from Russia to... Oh, so we've been mentioned that one already, haven't we? And there's a large amount of heroin in the place. The final point is when the Americans went in there, okay, it was to stop the Taliban, who actually weren't Afghanistanis anyway. They were a weird thing. I mean, if you've ever read A Thousand Splendid Sons or any of the books from that guy, there's an amazing history of Afghanistan. Personally, I think we should leave it alone. I mean, they almost killed my dad. That would have made a stop to me being here. That it's leave them alone. Get out of the bloody place.
Well, the point is, and this was the thing with the Taliban. I mean, the Taliban, as you say, they weren't Afghanis necessarily. Some were, some weren't. But the point is, they took over the country, turned it into a training camp for terrorists, and that is why the Americans went in there. What I think, well, all right, you say no, they didn't. Okay, fine, then end of conversation. I'm wrong.
And we go to the phone lines. We've got a call on the line. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
It's Paul. This thing about oil pipelines and oil. Listen, what are they going to do? Leave the oil in the ground? No, they want to sell it. And whoever buys it wants to get it out of the ground. They're making money out of it. It's a load of tripe, all this thing about oil. Oil is no good under the ground. And they haven't got the resources to get it out of the ground. So the investment that's put into these countries to get it out of the ground, it's their politicians that are making the money. Until they get their own country's politicians out of corruption, it will never be any different.
Thank you for your call in there, Paul. Rex, you want to come on a point here?
Well, the next golden oil is lithium. Because we'll all be driving electric cars very soon. And
right.
Lithium is going to be the golden commodity, not oil.
Is that your stock tip for the week, then?
It's
Rex?
My stock tip for the week. Got to keep your batteries topped up.
Right.
Yeah, but somehow you need to create the power to top up the batteries.
Indeed, and you can't do that by solar in Spain. Another thing I want to look at Trump's speech, the Senator Trump's speech, he said... Now, this is an interesting one. The young men and women we send to fight our wars abroad deserve to return to a country that is not at war with itself at home. We cannot remain a force for peace in the world if we are not at peace with each other. This may be a reference, would you think, to what's been happening domestically for Trump over the past 10 days?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. And once again, he did, unlike, I forget whether it was Saturday or whenever, when he just... you know, kind of exploded. He stuck to the message here that people expect the president of the United States to do, and that is try to calm down the divisions that do exist in the country. Nobody denies that. But if anything, on Saturday when he went off message and just said whatever he felt like to the surprise of his own people who had set up the event and everything else, who had set up one event and then he did something totally different, you know, that was Donald Trump doing Donald Trump. This was him staying on message that his people, whoever they are, had said, this is what you need to say. Or maybe he decided it himself, that at this point, this is what I need to say and bring the country together again. And those were, I think, very good words. Whether anybody is going to pay much attention, the fact that it's taken this long for him to say them after having been back and forth in both directions, you know, ever since the Charlottesville riots over a week ago.
I mean, the way he went off message was quite spectacular by saying that he had studied the videos or the images more closely than any of the journalists involved.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, he does everything more than anyone else. I mean, I don't know where he gets the time to do it all, but he must. He tells us that. Always.
John.
Yeah, I mean, the worrying thing I see... a whole thing, and I watch a wide raft of this. You have an ideological difference in America. You have on one side a group of people, the blue cities, as they're called, who actually want to have progressive socialism, globalism. They have a viewpoint of what America's doing. That's the way they want to push it. On the other side, you've got the other 50% of the country who want a traditional, constitutional-based, go-back-into-50s type situation. And there is no, it's just like Islam and the West, there's no compromise on that. You can't have half globalism and half traditional values in a country like that. And the worrying thing is you've got 2.5 million veterans in America who are all combat-trained. And as one of them said the other day, well, here's the situation. We've got 8 trillion rounds of ammunition and they can't decide which bathroom to use. So, I mean, it's a worrying situation. What Trump's doing is maybe trying to keep that powder pot down. But at the end of the day, I would reckon that the people that voted for Trump, who would also probably be most of that 2.5 million ex-veterans, are more likely to be the aggressors in this instance than I mean, the aggressors at the moment are all the liberals are coming out and they're trying to suppress anybody speaking anything they don't want said. They're prepared to go violent on it. That we've seen that the fascists are actually the anti-fascists. They're doing exactly what the Nazi Germans did in the 30s. They're suppressing anybody speaking anything you don't want. You've got somebody that's throwing sacks of urine at people just because they're white supremacist. I mean, white supremacist, you could probably put the whole lot in a football stadium that you wouldn't even fill it. There's not that many in the United States. It's a small little bunch of nutters. Antifa and BLM, whatever they're called, BLM, they're actually very aggressive. They're exactly the same techniques as the Nazis had. Squared. We've reversed the names. It's not the Nazis are now called themselves the anti-Nazis. And the actual Nazis are so small in number, get rid of them.
Well, if you walk around with a swastika, John, surely that makes you a Nazi. I'm sorry, if it, like I said, we had a very impassioned conversation about this last week, but if you're walking through with the symbols of hate, as they are, well, that actually, means you can't say that the people who oppose that...
Actually, when I lived in Malaysia, do you know one of the amazing things I saw was the swastika everywhere I looked?
Yeah,
it's an actual Indian peace symbol.
This we know.
It's the other way around, John.
But, you know, these people, the people who walk through Charlottesville with a swastika aren't saying, actually, we are, you know, we're using an Indian symbol of peace. These people are Nazis, yeah, John.
They're nutters. I mean, I know they're nutters, but how many were there compared to the Antifa lot? How many were there? And they weren't throwing urine at the Antifa lot.
Oh, no, they were throwing everything else.
Beating them.
Well, not on any of the videos I saw taken from within the camp. So, I mean, I think basically you have a complete diametrical opposition of the liberal viewpoint and the conservative viewpoint. And I can't see any way that you can actually blend those together. So that, to me, is very worrying, because America, if it goes to its new civil war, and again, it's terrible.
There's always been rumblings in the South there in America, going back between the wars, etc. I mean... It's left over from slavery, Ku Klux Klan, all of that. That's always been rumblings, and what we must ensure that they're not allowed to get out of control. But the point that Nathan made earlier about Trump keeping to his script, I remember, Nathan, you and I have had several discussions on this last year when I spoke to you about, before Trump got in, about whether you thought he might be groomed to behave like a president. We had this conversation, if you may recall. It's interesting that since then, and these past his 100 days now and everything, except for the other day when he read off script, or read on script, it seems that he hasn't yet been groomed, and he's still a bit of a wild cannon, isn't he, when he opens his mouth?
Absolutely no question. I mean, no one knows. And again, as we saw last Saturday, he said one thing which you knew was not scripted. I mean, again, just from the way he delivered it, this was Donald Trump talking. What he did yesterday, I mean, that was a scripted speech by whoever wrote it. And, you know, somebody, and I'm sure he was included. I mean, he's not going to stand there and say something that, you know, he thinks is ridiculous. But it was a well put together speech on different topics. But to say that, you know, he has learned anything, that we are still waiting to see, because today he may come out with something entirely different. And the problem is, no one has any idea that they figured him out or what he means when he says something, and whether what he says today means anything tomorrow. And we just don't know at this point yet. There is no confidence in any stability with him, because he changes his mind whenever he feels like it and just goes off on anything he wants.
And that's reassuring.
Well, good.
Also, the other thing, let's move away then from this, from the discussions that we had with the situation internally, you know, domestically in the States, and yesterday's speech in Afghanistan. North Korea is still ticking there quite nicely, and at the moment, the US and the South Korea are undergoing, which has to be said, it's a pretty annual event, isn't it? The exercises, the joint military exercises in South Korea, and North Korea is making these are provocations. Nathan, should we be more alarmed than normal during the build up for the past couple of months in North Korea to where we are now?
Well, it is alarming because, as we just said with Donald Trump, Kim Jong-un is less, I don't want to say less stable, but less easier to predict than bad as they were his father and his grandfather. I mean, he is much more a loose cannon, and he has bigger weapons than they ever had. So yes, there is concern, but it does follow the same pattern that has gone on for 40, 50, 60 years. The U.S. and South Korea have these annual exercises for any number of reasons. For the South Koreans, it's to show the North Koreans we're ready and you can't attack us. What North Korea has done every year when this happens, the leader of North Korea tells his people, see, they are preparing to attack us. This is the beginning of the attack. We have to be ready. Ramps everybody up. The million men on the on the border, we're waiting to repel them because these are not exercises. This is the beginning of the attack. Well, and then it never is. And then it calms down. Both sides, both Korea and or North Korea and South Korea, using it as a show of force to the other one that, look, we're powerful, you don't want to mess with us. And that's what it's always been. It has never gone over that line of anybody doing anything. Again, Kim Jong-un this time has backed off to the point of, well, I'm going to wait and see what the Americans and South Koreans do, but I'm not going to take the first action. And this is what has happened in both on both sides for the 40 or 50 years. They are saying, if I'm attacked, I'm going to win, but I'm not going to start it. What I think we have less confidence in at this point is Kim Jong-un maybe might start it. But if he is, as his father and grandfather did, well, they've had their exercises. I'm yelling and screaming about it, but okay, the exercises are over in, I think it's 10 days or something. They didn't attack this time, so I'm not going to do anything, and so we'll wait and go on and do it all again next year.
Rex, what's your take on the situation in Korea?
I have to say that it never ceases to amaze me how a podgy little Emmental-eating 28-year-old manages to create this enormous cult and keep people where he wants them. It's absolutely fascinating.
He is following the family business. I mean, he's not creating the cult himself.
But he's the youngest. He is the youngest, the least experienced, and yet he has this hold over his people. It is phenomenal. Whatever you say, it's phenomenal. We don't agree with it, but, I mean, it is quite incredible.
Compare it to a king or a queen in a country. Compare it to the Pope.
It's different.
Of course it's different because it is much more directly created. I mean, the Kim family and those who started with him have created this, and they have been able to lock themselves off from any other influence.
I mean, like, who wrote the manual for him to stay where he is?
His grandfather.
It's terrific. What a business.
I mean, look, the whole thing is, when the proverbial hits the fan, every peasant amongst us, that's all of us, have to decide which side of the fence we're standing on. We're going to go against this guy or we're going to go for this guy. If you go for this guy, you end up with a rank, you end up with a house, you end up with something, you end up with security, as long as he doesn't actually look at him the wrong way or something, but you've got a chance to living. If you go against him, you end up in the camps, you end up dead, you end up just nothing. So that's what happened in Korea, is they had a straight choice. Either you're going to go, oh, we all love you, and get on board, and you put on your equivalent of your Nazi swastika on your armband to show that you're actually a member of the party, and you're going to be prepared to kill even your own family in order to stay alive, or you oppose him and you get killed. That's a very simple way of doing it. Now, whether, I don't know, whenever I see a country being ostracized in the world, and certainly by America, and down for the attack list, I always look at really the main thing, and that is that if you look at all the countries that have been under attack recently, the one common denominator in them is that they didn't have a central bank. And North Korea doesn't have a central bank. It's not part of the central banking system. And I know Giles is looking confused on that. But, I mean, basically, there's control. And North Korea is going to be brought under control. And how it's done, I don't know. hopefully it's not done with nuclear weapons.
John, you're saying that we can't buy North Korean government bonds.
No, I'm saying that you can't control what their economy does. And if you look at South Korea, it's a pretty vibrant economy. North Korea's not.
The Chinese are doing quite well in controlling it, aren't they?
Yeah, the Chinese do, precisely. That's another reason. It's because it's Chinese. It's a buffer zone between the West and the East.
China are doing have so much more to lose by turning their backs on us rather than on North Korea.
Right, we're going to take a short break and then back with more Viewpoint. TRE.
Talk Radio Europe. Viewpoint with Giles Brown.
This is the Viewpoint Talk Radio Europe's current affairs programme with a panel. Joining me in the studio, Nathan Thomas, Rex Leyland and John Harper. 952-78-4000, the phone number. Studio@talkradioeurope.com, the email, the Facebook page, Talk Radio Europe Official, if you wish to leave a post. We're moving away from the States and the latest from President Trump. And we're moving to something closer to home in the UK as well. It was last week where the results of the A-level grades came out. Lots of young people going on to university. A friend of mine got his place at Edinburgh to study chemistry biology and medics, and I think it was well done. A's and A pluses. Grades were good, but reportedly fewer people are looking to go to university than in the past. A declining number of young people may be the reason. However, the idea that university isn't the be-all and end-all of where you should be going after you've done your A's, and apprenticeships are becoming more popular. Good, bad, realistic. If you were an apprentice, if you think it helps you get where you are today, give me a call. 952-78-4000, studio@talkradioeurope.com. Straw poll, university gentleman here, Rex?
No.
John?
No.
Nathan?
It depends. I mean, hey, I'll sit in the middle. But
is his CV or is actually talking?
I think it has been such a change over the past probably 20, 30 years over what college or university is all about. It used to be, you know, you went there to get a broad education in a lot of things. You did not go there to find a job. And now everybody looks at university as job training.
Passport.
And well, a passport to what?
To future employment.
Well, but it isn't. It never has been that. And if you use it that way, unless you're talking about something like law or medicine, I mean, that has always been university because it is so complicated, et cetera, that's the way people have always there used to be legal apprentices. You could apprentice with a lawyer for years and then become a lawyer yourself. But realistically, that's been done through universities. But an awful lot of work has nothing to do with this broad education. I mean, you grew up in a coal mining area. You went to work in the coal mines. Your father was a carpenter. You became a carpenter. You learned that trade. The broader education you never got. And you have, in most any country, a population that has gotten out of the basic education that the country has paid for, which roughly gets you to 16, 17, 18 years old. And then they have gone to, if it was a factory town, you went to work in the factory because there was a good job there. If you went into some kind of training, you were in training with other people who were training to be the same thing. So it limited your horizons tremendously. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing at all. It's just a fact of if you do it that way, that's the situation you're in. People who could went to university to get a broad-based education in a lot of things. And what has happened, I think, over the years, a lot of employers where you're employing a lot of people to do things other than run a machine. I train you to run the machine. This is the way you run the machine. You do that for the next 40 years, and that's your job. So much work now is so much more flexible and not specific. And so they are saying they are appreciating the fact that somebody who has gone to university for 4 years and has this broad-based experience of a lot of things, because a lot of times they want you to have a degree. They don't care what the degree is in, but it's the fact that you have gone through this 4 years of experience, which they feel is an advantage. Again, If you're looking for a carpenter, you don't need somebody who has a broad-based experience. If you need a plumber, if you need, you know, someone who has a specific skill, yes, university is really, you know, not necessary. For many people, it's a waste of time. But I think we have lost the idea of what university was and really still is. And part of that, especially in the UK, the big change has come from the fact that suddenly you have to pay for it. Because when it was free, well, it didn't matter. I'll go there for 4 years, and if employers of all sorts want a university education, fine, I've got one. But I'm going to study something that, you know, is never going to get me a job anyway.
John?
You've got to remember universities originally were the place where you could get knowledge, where you could meet people that had experience and knowledge. You could get an education. But it's not any longer the only place you can get knowledge. We now have, sitting in my pocket, I've got a smartphone that can give me access to all sorts of knowledge. Now, you've got to want to collect it. I spend half my life telling people how to do something, which they can't be bothered to look up themselves. So there's the factor. In that instance, I suppose, as far as modern technology goes, I'm a university professor because they come to me because they don't know how to do it.
Yeah. No, right? That's very possible and realistic. Everybody now has access to so much more information, but it is indeed, putting it into perspective, it's also the idea of being on a campus, meeting other people with other ideas who are interested in other things, that if you go to a training school to be a whatever it is, you're going to be in a school with a whole bunch of other people who have the same, who are pretty much like you. They also want to be a whatever that school is for, and you don't get this broad-based experience. And that, in the world today, in many areas of work, is a valuable commodity. Just having that experience, whatever your degree is in, is not nearly as important as the overall experience of doing that. But not if you are going to, you know, and I, you know, this is not a negative thing at all, but if you are going to work in a trade where you do this, I'm going to live in the village that I grew up in, I'm very happy here, it's a great life, that's fine. Then going to university may not be, you know, worth what it now costs you to do.
Yeah, I think people have given up on the idea. It was a time when even 30 years ago, 50 years ago certainly, the average person in England never moved more than 50 miles from their place of birth. Now we've got a situation where I sit in the middle of the campo here, middle of the countryside, and I can do business with 195 countries straight from my computer.
Yeah.
I mean, so where, you know, the world's changed, and universities for things like doctors, law, those sort of things, especially subjects, yes, we need them. For major arts and liberal arts degrees, I don't think we need universities. I think that those are things that can just be picked up anywhere. We used to be called, what do they call them there? There weren't universities. They upgraded.
Polytechnics.
Polytechnics, that's the word. They used to be called polytechnics. And, you know, stop all this thing. Yes, let university be free for people who are doing degrees. I said a long time ago that what we should do is, if you want to do a degree in architecture, I'm going to give you a state target credit card, and I'm going to give you an iPad, and I'm going to give you a course to go, and you're going to see all the famous architectural sites, and you're going to have to report back on it. And your first year of your university course will be actually going out and studying what you want to study in the real, and then when you come back, we can decide whether or not, and you can decide whether or not you actually really want to be an architect or a doctor. If you're a doctor, you're going to do a lot of time in India and see working in camps. Let's make them work that first year, and if at the end of that first year they've done their coursework, it's cost us money to send them around the world, but then after that, if they are going to be an architect, or they are going to be a doctor, or they are going to be a lawyer, give them the education, don't charge them for it, because we will get the benefit for it.
Unless they then, in this big wide world that we live in, move out and go to another country and do whatever it is done.
In which case you then bill them.
Well, sorry, I'm gone. No, but the problem is, and as so much does, it does get down to money. And whatever education you're getting is pretty much going to cost you or the government, because education now is so complicated because of the technology, because of the information, because of our ability to learn things and absorb things that just didn't exist in the same way before. And I think one thing that's going to happen in the UK, and this is already the case in the US, simply because we have never had free university education in the US. I mean, it doesn't exist. You know, if you have any intention of going to, and I use the words college and university interchangeably because in the US they are to a great extent, you know you're going to have to pay for it. You may be able to get a scholarship, you may be able to get a loan for part of it and whatever, but you are going to have to pay. And the one thing that has happened in the US, and this happened, you know, when I was, you know, a young child, parents start saving money for their kids' education when the kid is born. They set up a college fund. It doesn't happen in the UK because nobody ever had to before. I think it will start happening, especially when kids who have had to pay for their own university and gotten out and had this bill because all of it was done on money that they borrowed, they will come to the realization that exists all over the United States that if I, as a parent, start saving money then and so that I can pay for X amount of the education, at least part of it, then my child is not going to be saddled with this large student loan bill when he graduates. But that hasn't happened yet in the U.S. because the paying for your own university is really such a new thing.
Rex, you've got a couple of points you've been dying to make.
Yeah. Well, I'm from a slightly different era and background to Nathan. For myself, I attended hotel school, which was a college of further education. We weren't, in my day, able to do a degree in hotel management because there wasn't one. It came whilst I was attending further education. And with regards to payment, it was means tested. So my father had to pay for me to attend, whereas other fellow students, they got government grants that paid for their attendance and for their education. And my father was means tested, and I got the minimum, or he got the minimum amount of money from the government to further my education. With regards to your point on staying in the same town, I think geography, even 40, 50 years ago, didn't really matter because you had to go where the course was and where you needed to attend that particular institution. I think the difference between apprenticeships and university education, if we have more apprenticeships, it takes us back to a more manufacturing base. We've lost our skills, certainly in the UK, of manufacturing. If you go back hundreds of years, everything was made in Britain. Nothing is made in Britain anymore. We import it.
But can you afford to make it there anymore?
That is another point. But like everything else, you've got to have the right skills. We're now going through the Brexit thing. We've got to talk about bringing people in if there aren't enough at home. But there aren't enough at home because people are not learning skills. And they need to relearn skills, go back to manufacturing as a bolster, as a safety net to the service industry that Britain does so well, which now could be damaged because of Brexit. Hopefully it won't be, but it might be. So we've got to have some reserves. And I think further education, a good apprenticeship, there's nothing wrong with that. And it teaches you about life. You still have a solid education. You meet fellow students. You have a life of fun, learning, and growing up. And that's what it's about. And the behavior of many students attending further education institutions as against universities tends to be a little bit more saner and a little bit better than the wild antics of those privileged few at university.
We'll draw a line on that one. But the thing is with the university is the fact it's the aptitude. It shows the aptitude to study of the student. There was a line of thought a couple of years back that didn't really matter what degree you were doing because you'd have to do a postgraduate anyway. But it just showed that you had the ability to study and take in that information over the 4 years.
But the problem, and again, we have to remember apprenticeships used to be pretty much you were sold into slavery to the local carpenter or the local whatever who was going to teach you a trade. He let you sleep in some back room somewhere.
Yeah, I can see
you
that
didn't
point.
Get paid. I mean, but it worked.
But we had to go out. We were put into industry as part of your practical training.
Okay, somebody has to pay for that. But you were talking about manufacturing. I'm sorry, but big manufacturing is not going to come back to the UK any more than it's going to come back to the US. It's just not going to happen. And the sooner people start accepting that, I think they will be better off, because you can't afford to manufacture a lot of this stuff that we all want, because we're not going to pay triple what we're paying for it now, and that's exactly what it would be. It's just not going to happen.
Item warrants that, whatever it is that's being
manufactured.
You're going
to pay $1,500 for your cell phone?
Do you think
you tried
telling the Swiss to stop manufacturing watches?
Okay, fine.
You know, I mean, if you're prepared to pay for a Longines watch, you're going to pay for it. If you want a Rolls Royce, you pay for it.
Of course you are, and how many people do that?
You know?
I mean, I don't see
the Chinese are getting out of hand. Their wages are going through the roof. The Chinese are not going to sustain this forever, you know? There has to be a dilution around the world of jobs for everybody.
Well, again, it's a nice thought, but the jobs are going to go where they're cheap, because that's what people want. It's been proven over and over again. You give something, or you give a product that, okay, it's made in the USA or made in the UK or whatever, and you have a similar product that was made in Bangladesh and costs half as much. People buy the Bangladeshi product. It's human nature. It just happens. And are you going to pay?
Most people don't look at the label when they buy a product.
No, they don't. They look at the price. And you don't have to look at the label if you have two things and one of them is $50 and one of them is $20. You're going to find that one, the expensive one, is made locally.
Yeah. And the Chinese, of course, because they're now richer. They're buying other people's technology. They're buying the know-how from all of us who have invented that technology.
Yeah,
and
so?
So we've got to go back to apprenticeships and teaching people how to do things.
But then you have to have the jobs for them to do after you've taught them, and they're not there.
Viewpoint on Talk Radio Europe with Giles Brown.
You're listening to Viewpoint, Talk Radio Europe's current affairs programme, with a panel of invited guests where we discuss the issues of the day. So far, we've discussed the Barcelona attacks, we've discussed the variety of stuff with President Trump, and we've also discussed modern apprenticeships. But this week, Big Ben finally fell silent. Your thoughts, we've got about a minute and a half panel. Your thoughts on Big Ben falling silent? I'll start with you, Rex, because you're a Londoner through and through.
A big decision. Do the workers in the Tower of Big Ben, the Elizabeth Tower, should they be issued with very, very soft, padded, strong mufflers so they could continue their work without being interrupted every quarter of an hour? That is one point. The second point is it too PC, i.e. politically correct, that we are saving the workers and therefore shutting down Big Ben so that they don't have to wear the mufflers and they keep their hearing? That's the point. And can we live 4 years without Big Ben? Let's wait and see.
Will we miss Big Ben's bongs, John?
As long as it's there to go bong on the day that we finally leave the EU, I don't care.
Well, it won't be, because it's not coming back for another 4 years.
Well, they have to turn it on then.
They are turning it on for special occasions.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, New Year's Eve, and I forget what other...
Remembrance Sunday.
Yes.
Right. Brexit exit.
Probably Brexit.
But the reality is, isn't it wonderful we have the modern technology that everybody can still hear Big Ben on their iPhones if they want to, or on anything else? When you saw the pictures of people who were there for the last round of it, how many people were recording it?
I like the pennies on the weight, adding the extra pennies to keep it working. That I thought was spectacular.
Right, they've always had time. Thanks to my guest, John Harper.
Hello, thank you.
Goodbye and thank you.
And of course, Nathan Thomas.
See you next week.
This will be available at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much.
My invited studio guests and callers do not constitute an opinion endorsed in any way by Talk Radio Europe SL.
Viewpoint on Talk Radio Europe.